This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
There's never been a more exciting time to be a Muslim. The global movement of Muslims, the rise of Islamophobia, and the advancement of information technology has created some beautiful discussion. Today, I sit down with Sheikh Abdullah Hakim Quick to talk about Islam and modernity, and we talk about the rise of Islamophobia, we talk about the rise and fall of Islamdom, and also some of the conflicts of being a Muslim living in the West. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. How are you doing?
Wa alaikum assalam, Allah. Fine.
Allah barik fi jazakallah khair. So I want to start off, inshallah, by quoting Marshall Hodgson. This is a 1993 book that he's written here, and this is something I think is really of great interest. He says, in the 16th century, a visitor from Mars might have supposed that the human world was on the verge of becoming Muslim. So he was looking at the time when Islamic civilization, as a matter of fact, he actually referred to it as Islamdom, was at the top, really the peak of the time, and this is the 16th century. Talk to me a little bit about how we were really as Muslims at that time, and what happened for us that we got here.
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's important to look at Islam not in one particular time period, but to connect it, you know, to its evolution. And Ibn Khaldun, you know, the great scholar who wrote the Muqaddima, an introduction to a history of the world. He looked at Islamic society in cycles, that there are some points where it's very high, where they're practicing and staying to their traditions and their culture, their base, and other times when they lose it and become tribalistic and materialistic, it goes down. So we've gone, literally gone, you know, in waves. And we're talking about the 7th century, that we're rising up in the 6th, 7th century. And then within 100 years, Islam had reached to China. It was all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, far north in Russia, deep south in the Swahili coast. And so a great part of the known world, you know, was relating to Islam. But then there were waves of changes that came about. There were the conquests of the Crusaders that were coming from Europe. There were the Mongols who swept across the Muslim world. And you have to remember now, that this is, we're talking about the 13th century. It is then when Baghdad was destroyed by the Mongols. Okay, so if you look at certain sections of the Muslim world, you'll see high points. Other points, you'll see low points. By the 16th century, this is where the Ottoman Empire had reached its peak. And it was in a key strategic position, being in Constantinople was Istanbul. And so it was affecting much of the world because of trade, because of their influence militarily, and then also because of the scholarship. They were supporting, you know, Muslim scholars to a certain extent. So this is why that person from Mars, actually, you know, if he landed in Istanbul and he saw the size of those masjids and he saw the community, which at the time of Sultan Suleiman, the Magnificent, he had developed, or the Ottomans had developed a society where Christians, Jewish, Muslim, and other groups could live in justice. So they had minority groups. People around the world were relating. But at the same time, if that Martian had landed in Spain, in Granada, at that time, the Muslims had been destroyed by the Catholics, you know, the 16th century. It was 1492 when Abu Abdullah signed over Granada to the Catholic king and queen. So Muslims were gone in Europe after being there for 781 years. But if you look at the world in general, Muslims were in a very high position.
So, I mean, it's actually interesting that you've tied this down to the talk of Ibn Khaldun when you say when I'm just trying to be devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. I guess we talk and we say when Muslims are attached to the religion, they are high up, and when they're not, they are down. But I mean, the other side of this argument is the fact that the West is not very religious.
Right.
And now they're doing well. They're doing much well. We talk about them from just a materialistic world, in a sense.
Really. Yeah. Well, you know, when the Syrians first encountered the Crusaders, and it was the Turks and the Syrians were really right at the place where the Crusaders were coming in. And they described them, you know, as animals with good fighting spirit. In other words, they had no culture. They were like
this is the Syrians describing
the Syrians were describing the European Crusaders, mm-hmm. right? They had lost the Roman culture. They were wild, but they had a good fighting spirit. And the real loss for Islam or for the Muslim world came from within. Is that arrogance, because they underestimated, you know, the Europeans, and because they were so busy fighting and squabbling amongst themselves.
So instead of saying underestimating the Europeans, can we actually, Europeans is a much better option, I guess, really.
Yeah. So the problem for the Muslims was that they underestimated the Crusaders.
Now, I just want to jump into what we consider as the relationship between tradition and modernity in religion, period, and Islam specifically.
Right.
First of all, are these even contradicting ideas, being traditional and modern at the same time, I guess?
Well, basically, you know, if we can go back to the beginning, you know, and look at how, you know, Islam developed, and the fact that the Prophet ﷺ told his companions to seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave, you know, that it was, you know, compulsory on all Muslims. So looking for knowledge, you know, and traveling and assimilating it was part of the Islamic identity. So in the golden age of Islam, Muslims were the most modern people in the sense that they were taking cutting-edge ideas and theories, putting them into practice and using them in their society. So that's the essence of this modernity. It's a way of like taking your society from one level to another level, to a higher level. And so when the Islamic society was, you know, dynamic, and this is, you know, going up to the year 1000, 1100, 1200, especially if we use, for instance, Al-Andalus, yeah, Spain and Portugal as an example,
yeah,
because that's in Europe.
Yeah.
So the Muslims are now leading the world. Around the year 1000, the city of Cordoba, it had lighted streets, running water, universities, public baths. It took Paris and London 500 years to reach that level.
After that time.
Yeah. So they were the most modern people. Now, once when the Muslims again became divided, materialistic, went away from their traditions, meaning their Quran, their Sunnah, their consensus, their ijma, their Islamic outlook, when they left that, authority was taken away from them, and they became subjugated. So living in subjugation, whether it is in Spain under the Inquisition, or whether it is later on in what they call the colonial period, and this is coming in from the 18th, 19th century, you know, in much of the Muslim world, we're colonized. So therefore, the knowledge in the universities is no longer dynamic because it's not connected with the economy.
Yeah.
It's not connected with the political structure. So when the political structure is dynamic, you know, and funds the universities and the ulama, you know, and when the technology is in sync, you know, with Islamic lifestyle, then Muslims are dynamic. Mm-hmm. But when it's out of sync, and this is what happened, the colonial period came, and so it was a type of European secularism, because the Europeans were rebelling against the church.
Yeah.
And as we know from back in the 15th century, what they call the Dark Ages, if you did scientific experiments, you could actually be killed. Mm-hmm. So when they had their renaissance around the 15th, 16th century, and they were reborn, this is where this new thinking comes in, the Enlightenment, they call it.
Yeah.
So this is the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And their Enlightenment, because of the negative response to the church, it was anti-religion. Mm-hmm. It was irreligious.
So this is interesting. Does the idea of Enlightenment have to be anti-religion?
It doesn't, but yeah. I'm saying in the European model, and how it is used, how we're taught from a Eurocentric perspective.
Yeah.
We're taught that Enlightenment, you know, was going away from the dogmatic teachings of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when Muslims were dynamic, and what is built into Islamic thought is that there's no difference between the sacred and the secular in terms of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So Enlightenment for us, you know, is modernization in a sense that, you know, we are becoming very modern and we're using higher technology. But we're not leaving the principles of Islam. So this is a difference. This is the difference between Enlightenment that happened in Europe and Enlightenment that happened in the Muslim world.
But the debate always happens, I guess, really into, the principles of religion itself. Who defines those? I mean, when we talk about, because there is a lot of differences in who defines the principles of religion?
Well, the scholars, naturally, who are called the ulama, you know, they are the ones who study the religion in detail. But we have to recognize the fact, again, that scholars who are not connected to the state, scholars who are not funded and who are not dynamic, can actually become an obstacle in the way of progress. And this is what happened in the colonial period, where the scholars became stagnated because they were living under colonial rule and they were literally hiding Islam and not dealing with science.
Whereas, do you have any examples of this kind of thing?
The examples are the great Darul Uloom, the Islamic universities. Even from Saudi Arabia, I'm not mentioning names, there are scholars who even said up in the 20th century, the earth is flat. That came out of Muslim scholars' mouth. Whereas,
what was the justification for this?
Well, the justification, I guess, is that if you look at the sky is above, the earth is below, you know, so therefore that's a flat plane, you know, in a sense. Whereas Al-Idrisi, you know, he did a globe, you know, for Roger I in Sicily in the 11th century. He literally made a globe for him. So he was one of the leading Islamic historians, geographers, and scholars. So Muslims knew that the earth was spherical, right? But I'm saying when we're not in touch with scientific knowledge, when we separate the sacred from the secular, then we have a problem. When you go back again to the golden age of Islam, you see Ibn Rushd, you know, for instance, who is a scholar in fiqh, Bidayat al-Mujtahid. You know, he does a great book in comparative fiqh. At the same time, he's dealing with philosophy, he's dealing with science, he's dealing with other things at the same time.
Overall scholarship, I guess really is what you're talking about, is really kind of like a, not just scholarship within specific kind of, I guess really a body of knowledge, but he's a scholar all around.
That's right. So the curriculum of the Islamic institutes has to go back to that original concept where the sacred and the secular are considered all from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is not a narrow curriculum. What happened in the colonial period is that if you wanted to get your secular scientific studies, you would go to an English school or a French school or a Dutch school. If you wanted your religious studies, you would go to the Islamic seminary. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happened in the seminary is that they were really strong on quoting traditions, but it was irrelevant because they were talking about 1,000 years ago. Right, so now, you know, what has to develop now and what is going on is that you'll see more scientists in the Muslim world, educated people in a secular sense, who are now becoming religious. And you will see it's coming back now, where the marriage between the sacred and the secular. You know, and once that happens, you know, then that dynamism can return. But there needs to be that, what you could call, holistic approach to knowledge.
So this is actually interesting what you talk about this here. But I guess really the question that I want to maybe kind of move on to is, why have we become this way? I mean, I don't want to always, I know you've answered this before and you've said, you know, when we move away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but there's got to be some sort of actual physical reasons that have come about. I mean, a lot of people have pointed to colonialism, a lot of people have pointed to, but is it sufficient for us to just say that it's just the Western world colonized the Muslims and they've caused all this backwardness?
No, I wouldn't say so. I would say that the greatest cause of our decline came from ourselves. And the Prophet ﷺ said, "Inna li kulli umma fitna wa fitna tu ummati al-mal." Every nation has a trial and test. The trial and test of this nation is wealth. And so when materialism came in and Muslim leaders started fighting and squabbling over materials and fighting over, you know, land space, and ego and power, and then tribalism comes in, and then treachery and infighting comes in, then the whole state becomes weak. And when the state becomes weak, then the opposing forces have an opportunity to attack, because they're always there. And so when they literally pounced on the Muslim world in different waves of crusaders, Mongols, colonial forces, they physically took apart the leadership. So they physically broke down the political institutions. They broke down the economic institutions, and they put in the interest system. there's a discussion about the Ottoman Empire, you know, and one scholar is saying that, you know, for the first few hundred years, you know, the world, you know, the Muslim world and the world was ruled by religious type people. You know, then, you know, it changed. And now what is happening, it is bankers. It is bankers who are ruling the world. And so literally when that new economic system came in and we were conquered, we couldn't bring alternatives. And so the whole political and economic system then caved in. And so the expressions that would come out of the scholars at that point would be very weak expressions, because they're not representing a holistic society. They're only representing a so-called religious side of things, which, if it's not connected with the changes in society, can become outdated and backward. And that is the reason why people will look at some Muslim scholars and say, you're backward. You're 1,000 years old. Because maybe that person really is reading the commentaries of scholars who lived 1,000 years old, and depending upon that commentary to interpret what's happening today. Whereas what they should do is that, you know, look at the commentary in the time period it was made, go back to the sources of Islam, take that ijtihad, that type of Islamic reasoning, and apply it to today.
But doesn't that require some sort of training? Does that training even happen? To kind of provide that kind of relevancy? I mean, you've studied in the Middle East and you've studied also in the West. Mm-hmm. And I guess really the question that I always, you know, I get worried about asking, because I don't want to be labeled as anything, but is that training actually happening? I mean, the real Islamic scholarship, we always say it comes from the East. You know, a lot of people always say that. You know, we can debate that. But is that training happening there? Is there some sort of, you know, how do you make the material that's been written thousands of years ago? How do you make that relevant to today? And not just today in the East, because you can do that sometimes, but to Muslims living in the West.
You know, it really is daunting, you know, when you think about the state of scholarship.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get you in trouble by asking questions that are strange.
It gets political. But the thing is, though, is that, you know, the universities are tied to the governments, man.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
And you know, the universities have been squashed. Mm-hmm. So literally, the universities do not prepare you to make ijtihad. It does not prepare
not
you
even
to...
Not even that.
To,
I mean...
It only prepares you to, like, imitate.
Yeah. So if you look at some of the universities that are happening... So how you get into universities in the Middle East first, for instance, right? You get into universities based on your the mark that you get in high school, right?
Right.
But you get into Islamic universities at a much lower rate, you know what I mean, than when you go into medicine or into, right? Because you're expected to make less money as a scholar. Mm. Anyways, you're supposed to, you know, you can have a PhD in Islamic studies tomorrow from University of Omdurman. You know what I mean? But to just have like a medicine degree, it's expensive. And it takes a lot of study and so on. So people just kind of like, this is the easy way out. And what ends up happening is that you end up getting, if you'd excuse what I say, but you get the really dumb people.
That's what
to become the students of, and then what do stupid people do? They just memorize and they just spit out whatever they memorize, right? They don't actually have any way of putting in a sort of
relevance. I mean, literally in some countries, I don't want to use Syria because Syria is in such a sad state. But literally, I was told that they literally looked at the graduating class. Mm-hmm. And they said the top 5%, you're going to medical school whether you like blood or not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then
so
the next one,
Sudan, by the way.
Engineers, right? Accountants, lawyers. Yeah. You know, and then the lowest 20% or 10%, you know, the troublemakers.
They go into...
They said, yalla, make them, you know, the
teachers.
Sharia.
No, they make them teachers. You go into...
Or else you go be a Sharia.
Or you become teachers, you become imams, you become the memorizers of Quran.
Right.
You become like the guys who run things.
And sometimes the ones who is the ifrit...
Social scientist.
The ifrit in the class, he studies, you know, Quran.
Yeah.
So this ifrit graduates, and now he's your imam.
Yeah. I guess you could answer the question is, you know,
how
do we prepare the scholarship, in a sense, to tie or to create some sort of relevancy between what's been written thousands of years ago and our modern day state?
What is happening now, if you look at the Middle East and Islamic countries, there is an evolution that is going on. And during the colonial period, the curriculums were restricted. They were restricted to so-called religious studies. So therefore, you know, there was a maintenance of the Quranic studies, the isnad, you know, the chain of narrators, the hadith. So many of these studies of tafsir, Arabic language, that was okay. But when it came to like fiqh, understanding, dynamism, ijtihad, making decisions, applying your Islam to today, teaching, giving dawah, this part changed. Mm-hmm. And it became fossilized. So the curriculums in many of the Islamic institutions are fossilized curriculums. And what has to develop is that we need to go back to the original model. And that is a holistic type of curriculum, where the student is studying Arabic language and studying Quran. And then the next period is math. He studies hadith, and the next period, chemistry. And then when you're finished, you not only learn what dawah is, usus ad-dawah, or the principles of dawah, you actually, and that is to spread Islam and teach Islam, you actually get field training in how to do it. You not only read about the qualities of an imam, they actually show you how to be an imam. They actually teach you how to give a proper khutbah, which is training. What's happening now is that many of the students who come out of the Islamic universities, they memorize their notes. They're really good at memorizing and imitating. But when it comes to leadership, they have not been prepared for this. So therefore, there needs to be a type of leadership institute, right? A type of higher level institute where the best of those who go through the base studies are actually given now special training so they can deal with the 21st century. They're taught IT skills. They're taught how to speak, how to deal in modern society, you know, and then they combine the two. Mm-hmm. So that level of the teaching actually is missing. Mm-hmm. And that originally was there because when a person gave an ijazah in the past, which is like bihaqqa riwayah, which is the right to teach on me, he doesn't do that until he lets that student teach the class. So in other words, he wasn't just a good parent. No, he teaches the class and he watches him. Mm-hmm. He criticizes him till he reaches the point where he said, now you have the right to teach my class. What is happening now is that the students only have the right, they've memorized what the teacher taught. So what happens in many Islamic institutions is that you have the students of the real teachers who were never taught to teach. They were only taught to memorize. So therefore you get a stagnated, fossilized curriculum and the students come out and they're not capable to handle the challenges of the 21st century.
So how can this change be made? I mean, really, to be honest with you, now if you think about it, you're talking about a change in not only the curriculum, but I guess really even in the approach of how the curriculum itself is to be applied. But one has to remember that these universities are not really private universities; they're universities that are attached to bigger institutions.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, do you think because living in the West, we're capable of actually creating, you know, independent universities. Do you think that this kind of movement, I guess, really of, I don't want to say revolutionize, I don't want to even say modernize, but I say really...
To revive.
Yeah, to revive.
Reviving the Islamic...
Islam, for instance. Can this happen from the West?
It can happen from the West to a certain extent. But the reality is, the revival cannot really happen until there is a country, until there is a land within the lands of Islam that actually reflects this. Because, you know, the full revival of Islam requires a state. It does require institutions that are funded by the economy of the society. So when the economy of the society, and this is where traditional ministry of awqaf, the waqaf, so that's where the zakat and the trusts of the society, you know, used to fund the institutions. So the scholars were then not tied to politics.
Yeah.
You know, they were independent. They could criticize the politicians.
It was a system of a tenure.
Right. So therefore, I mean, you know, it was based upon a trust,
yeah,
a zakat trust, which is part of, you know, the rights of the whole society.
Yeah.
That's a completely different concept. So in other words, that student, you know, is given a scholarship, you know, which came through the system of zakat. That is where Muslims gave their charity for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so it was the right of the student to study Islam given by the Creator.
Yeah.
It wasn't given by a political party or a benevolent king.
Or a government, yeah.
Or a government.
Yeah.
It was independent. So once you have the political group, and you have the ulama scholars who are separate, and then you have the people who are the umara, you have civil society that is also separate. And Muslims were the ones who brought civil society to Europe, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, so when you have these different groups that struggle together, right, instead of against each other,
yeah.
You know, then you have that dynamism. And really the West, what's happening out the West, I believe, some of the thinking, some of the seeds that can be planted in the lands of Islam are coming from the West. But the actual tree that will grow has to be in a land that is fertilized with Islam. And we cannot impose Islam on the Western countries. That's not why we're here. We are living, in a tolerant way in these societies.
Mm-hmm.
We're not imposing Islam. But within the Islamic lands, it needs to evolve to the point where, the dynamism of Islam can return.
Do you think there's a conflict between being a Muslim and a Westerner at the same time?
No, because the whole concept of Westerner, in a sense, if you look at Europe coming out of its dark ages, you know, and this is, say, around the 15th century, right, Muslims were the ones for 700 years who kept the light of civilization going. We were the ones who had the universities in Cordoba, in Granada, in Toledo, in Seville, and Valencia, that literally taught the European scholars. So it is the Muslims who started the Renaissance period, keeping the light of civilization going. Then it was the European societies who translated the works of the Muslims and then added their own thinking. You know, and then they had their industrial revolution. You know, they started traveling around the world in their boats, and they colonized the world. So Western, in a sense, there is no West and no East. And it's very interesting because there's a point in Spain, it's around the year 1000 or just before the year 1000, where the Khalifa Abdurrahman al-Nasir al-Dinillah, you know, who was a great leader of Al-Andalus in Spain, and to the point where, because of the weakness of the other leaders in the Muslim world, he declared that he was a Khalifa. And that is the ultimate ruler of the Muslim world. And there were European leaders who were paying homage to him. So they would travel from Germany, from Switzerland, they would travel west to the Khalifa. So the Muslims were the Westerners, and the Germans were the Easterners.
Yeah.
You see East and West?
Yeah, yeah.
So they literally traveled from East-West to meet the Khalifa, because Baghdad and Tunisia with the Fatimids, it was corrupted.
Uh-huh.
So really, the basis of Westernism came to a great extent from Muslims.
Uh-huh.
So this whole idea of a Westerner, I mean, Western society didn't just come out of nowhere. It came out of the contributions made by people in civilizations for the past 5,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the Muslims just happened to be the ones, you know, who had the light, you know, just before the Europeans got it. So therefore, if you went the year 1000 to the year Cordoba, you would find a Muslim who is taking baths, who has soap, who has running water in his house, who has lighted streets, they have hospitals, they're educated. Christian, Muslim, Jews study together. Tolerant society. You can criticize the leadership. These are Western values, what we call Western today. Whereas many of the so-called Western countries, if you went to Brittany and you went to France and you went to Germany, you will find that it was very darkened societies, no running water, no lighted streets, no public baths. No institutions of learning, or very few institutions of learning. So therefore, it was the Muslims who were the so-called Westerners, if you mean enlightened people.
Uh-huh.
We say, la sharqiyya wa la gharbiyya.
Uh-huh.
There's no East and there's no West, really. Okay, it is who is enlightened and dynamic and who is backward. And Muslims have the opportunity to come out of backwardness into enlightenment if they return to the original holistic approach to knowledge.
Sheikh Abdullah, this is a fascinating talk, mashallah. May Allah Azza wa Jalla bless you, inshallah. I do want to come back again and talk to you, inshallah, about other topics.
Okay.
Jazakallah khair for being with us here today.
Alhamdulillah, barakallah.
So this is it for today, folks. We've spoken to Sheikh Abdullah Hakim Quick about Islam and modernity. Next time, we'll speak about Islam and democracy. If you have any questions to ask to the Sheikh, please comment below and we will ask it to the Sheikh next time we see him. Until next time, see you. Have a good day.